One of the neat things that we're doing as we look at the book of Daniel, you know, these stories or these historical narratives that we look at in the book of Daniel, so many times we learn them from our youth, and we often learn them as kind of independent stories. We don't always see them together as they are in the book of Daniel. And so sometimes some of these stories are somewhat connected and build on the previous story, or at least grow out of the previous story, as we'll see is the case in our lesson tonight. So when we get to do something like we're doing this week and looking at the book of Daniel and looking at these historical episodes in the book of Daniel, we get to see that connection somewhat. And I think in some ways it makes what we're studying more powerful and more meaningful and more impressive to us. I have said already that the book of Daniel, obviously, if you've ever read it, you recognize that it contains some tough apocalyptic sections in chapters 7 through 12. And the overriding message of those apocalyptic symbol sections assures us that God is sovereign, that he is in control, and that his people will ultimately triumph. Chapters 3, 5, and 6 contain historical narratives that show the accuracy of the central truths that will later be revealed in those symbols, that God is in control over all things, even over kings, and that he will deliver his people from whatever threatens them. Chapter 4, which we'll look at tomorrow night, combines the symbolic language along with historical narrative to demonstrate it demonstrates exactly the same point. The same point is made in that story as well. And so we'll see that. And what I want to keep trying to impress you with as you look at these historical narratives, and please understand, I'm not calling them stories. I may slip and say that from time to time, but these are not stories. These are not fictional stories. These are historical narratives. These are events that actually took place in time and space. These are things that actually happened. And so we are looking and reading about these events that actually took place in time and space, and the God that is the center of these historical narratives is exactly the same God that you and I serve. And though it is important to note that God will not always remarkably deliver his people, that is, he may not always deliver us, or he may not deliver us in a miraculous way sometimes, he will deliver us ultimately. He will deliver his people ultimately. He may deliver us this side of eternity, or he may actually use eternity as his means of delivering us. But in accord with his purpose, he will deliver his people, and ultimately we will triumph. I've done some study and some preaching recently in the book of Psalms, and one of the Psalms that I sometimes preach from is Psalm the 34th chapter, and verse 19 makes this comment, "Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all." And if I share with you just something that diverts from the book of Daniel for just a moment, just by way of helping to make the point that I'm trying to make here at the very beginning, immediately this statement actually immediately precedes a statement that is quoted by John in John chapter 19 and applied to the Messiah. It's that part about not a bone of his body shall be broken, and was applied to the time when they did not break the legs of Jesus on the cross. And so you would think, reading this text from the New Testament perspective, that this psalm must be a messianic psalm. But really, when you examine the context of Psalm 34, you will find that it is not really a messianic psalm. In fact, there are sections of it, for example, the 34th Psalm, verses 12 through 16, are actually quoted in the New Testament. In 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 10 through 12, I believe it's around there, it's quoted in the New Testament to encourage us and to instruct us on how to enjoy a long life. And so the things that are said in this psalm have application sometimes to us. And what you really look at as you study Psalm 34 is you find a psalm that is talking about God's helping all of those who are righteous sufferers, and that Jesus is one of the righteous sufferers that the Lord delivers. Of course, when we think about that, and because it says many are the wounds of the righteous, but the Lord delivers them out of them all, and then it references this text that we know is applied to Jesus, we question sometimes, did God deliver Jesus from the suffering that he experienced? Well, I would suggest to you that God, if it would appear that he did not save Jesus or deliver Jesus, if we view the world only from our perspective. But when we try to take God's perspective and understand that he views the world that is not confined to time and space and the physical planet, that God can also work in the realm of eternity as he lives there. And the point is that sometimes God does use eternity as his means, and I believe that the Lord did deliver, that the Father did deliver from the Son from his afflictions, not delivering them from the afflictions, but through those sufferings, through resurrection from the dead. And I would suggest to you that sometimes is exactly what happens to us. As we talk about the fact that God is in control of our world and that God's people will triumph and that ultimately he will deliver them from whatever threatens them, please don't get the impression that we're saying that if you're suffering, God is certainly going to take your suffering away. He may not. The truth of the matter is, I may not get out of this thing alive. I may have to die before my suffering is relieved, but God can still deliver me by using eternity. And so what I want you to understand then is that God's people ultimately do triumph. He may not save us by a miracle. He may not even save us out of our suffering here on this side of of eternity. But according to his purpose, he will ultimately deliver us in the way that he understands and sees fit, that is best for us and best for his purposes. And so the challenge tonight and throughout the rest of the week is for us to all stand back, watch his great power in action, and believe. That's what I want you to do. Stand back, watch his great power in action, and hopefully it will compel you to believe in this great God and to put your confidence and trust in him. So I want to turn now in the book of Daniel to the third chapter in the story that occurs in Daniel chapter 3. We call this lesson Three Men in a Fire. And I will remind you, as I mentioned earlier, that the neat thing about doing this is that we can kind of use the previous, sometimes see the connection between the previous text because of the way we're looking at this. You remember last night as we talked about the events that occurred there, that it would almost appear as if Nebuchadnezzar had converted on the basis of some of the things that he says. In the second chapter, for example, in verse 47. After Daniel is able to not only reveal his dream but interpret his dream to him, the king answered Daniel and said, "Surely your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, since you have been able to reveal this mystery." That sounds like someone who is saying, "Your God is the right God. Your God is the true God." And I would suggest to you that this king was most certainly impressed with the God of Daniel. But though he was impressed, he quickly got over it, as we will see from the third chapter, and creates for himself another God. And that's how the third chapter begins. It begins by telling us about Nebuchadnezzar building this large image of gold. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, chapter 3 and verse 1, the height of which was 60 cubits, and its width 6 cubits. That's about 90 feet tall by 9 feet wide. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. And Nebuchadnezzar sent word to the assembly and the satrap, to assemble the satraps and the prefects and the governors and the counselors and the treasurers and the judges and the magistrates and all the rulers of the province to come to the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So he builds this large statue, and it would appear that it might be reminiscent of this thing that he envisioned in the dream that he had had in the previous chapter. I don't know, but it seems to maybe have been something like that. Of course, you understand that right here, as we begin to look at this story, and as we begin to read it from the critic's eye, we recognize that the critic immediately begins to find fault with the book of Daniel. There are things in the book of Daniel, even in the apocalyptic section, that are so clear in terms of knowing future historical events and clearly outlining historical events, actually naming coming kingdoms like the Medo-Persian kingdom and the Greek kingdom, and describing them in very detailed ways that make it clear that the one who's speaking, that Daniel, as he reveals those things, sees what's happening in the future. Because they're so clear, the critic who does not accept God and who does not believe the Bible is the Word of God immediately will try to do everything he can to discredit the book of Daniel. Of all the books of the Old Testament, particularly, the book of Daniel is one of those which finds itself most frequently under fire by the critics. They're constantly trying to somehow find fault with it so that they can debunk its message. We're going to find out that that's a dangerous thing to do with the book of Daniel, but we'll talk about that as we go through. But the interesting thing is that they, as the critic reads this story, he immediately begins to find fault. What about this 9 foot wide by 90 foot tall image? They will say that that is disproportional. And I guess that is somewhat disproportional, 9 foot wide by 90 foot tall. But what if? What if this image had been placed on a pedestal of 40 foot or something, so that the whole thing totals 90 foot? What I want you to understand is that if you read the text, it doesn't have to be read from the perspective that finds some kind of fault. There are ways to read the text that help us to make complete sense of the thing. The other thing that they do again is they talk about the fact that it was an image of gold. And what they will say is that an image that size of solid gold would be far too extravagant. That could not possibly have been done. Of course, the text never says that it was made of solid gold. It says it was a gold statue, a gold image. It could have been an image that had been overlaid with gold. So my point again is that if you want to read this from a critical eye and you want to find fault, sure, you can find some things that are faulty or that might appear to be faulty, but the point is, as you read that, if you're careful and you read it open-mindedly, you don't have to find ways. I mean, these things do not have to be something that is a problem at all. These things can be easily explained. And so we just sort of dismiss the critics. We know they're biased. They're not willing to look at these things objectively and see them in ways in which these things can make sense. They want to read them in ways that they don't make sense because they're trying to discredit the book. So we'll ignore that and we'll just go back to the story and see that this king builds this large image. And he calls together all of his rulers, all of his governors and magistrates and all of the men in charge of the various provinces. He calls these people together for the dedication of this image. And so the satraps and the prefects and the governors and all these guys come together. They are assembled for the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And then the herald speaks. The herald loudly proclaimed, "To you the command is given, O people, nations, men of every language, that at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the lyre, the trigon, the psaltery, the bagpipe, and all kinds of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar has set up." What a crummy message this herald had. I am so glad that the message that I get to herald as a preacher of the gospel of Christ is not the kind of crummy message that this guy had to herald. He has to speak about a dead, dumb idol, something that was the creation of man's own mind. And he says, "We've got to come down and worship this dead, lifeless idol." What a crummy message. It's not at all like the good news of the message that we get to herald as preachers of the gospel today. Our message is not about a dead God. It is not about a God of human creation, but rather it is about the living God, the true God, and the living Savior, the Son of God. I'm so glad I get to herald that message and not the message that this guy gives. Well, the message is that you've got to come down, and when you hear this musical instruments, you're supposed to fall down and worship. And the threat is, in verse 6, whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire. Therefore, at that time, when all the people heard the sound of all these musical instruments, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language fell down and worshipped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And for the moment, it would seem that everything is okay. But in verse 8, we read that for this reason, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and brought charges against the Jews. I'm going to suggest to you that these are certain unnamed Chaldeans. And I would suggest to you that there always has been, and there always will be, certain unnamed Chaldeans, as it were, who are ready and willing to accuse the faithful. In this story, the names of those Chaldeans are not remembered. But the names of the three faithful Jews that they seek to accuse, we remember: Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Because we see in the story that they said, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of these musical instruments and all kinds of music is to fall down and worship the golden image. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast in the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. There are these certain Jews whom you have appointed over your administration of the province of Babylon, namely Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have disregarded you. They do not serve your gods or worship your golden image, the golden image which you have set up. Here are these men who charge Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego with violation of the king's edict. And it was true. They hadn't bowed. Their motivation is undisclosed, but it may have been that it was a jealousy going back to earlier times when you remember that Daniel and these three men, his three buddies, were kind of moved ahead of the other wise men. You'll remember in the previous chapter that they're set up over other things and some of the wise men are left behind, and so it may have been that there was jealousy. I don't know what did. But they are moved to accuse Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And so now this rebellious trio, this three men who have not bowed to the image as the king has decreed, they must face the rage of their king Nebuchadnezzar. And I want you to know, it's hard to face somebody who's angry at you. It's especially hard to face the rage of an angry tyrant. But it's even more than that in this story. Because they're not opposing just any angry tyrant. They're actually opposing one who had honored them by raising them in the kingdom. Think about that a minute. You know, it's hard to face someone who's angry at you. But when that person has done something good for you, as the king had done for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, he had elevated them. He had moved them forward, given them good places in his provinces. He had treated them well because of the things that they had done. And now they must go against his will. They must do that which enrages. They must face his rage. And that's harder. It's harder sometimes, when someone's done us good, to stand in opposition to them when they're doing something that is wrong. And so even though it was harder for them, these young Jewish boys do it anyway, because their God is greater than this king. In verse 14, Nebuchadnezzar responded, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, when these three boys are brought before him, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you have not served my gods or worshipped the golden image that I have set up?" It's almost as if he can't believe it. But he's ready, as difficult as he is for him to understand why these guys, who he's done good things for, why they won't bow to his image. He's ready to offer them another chance. Surely they will bow this time. He says to them, now if you are ready, at the moment you hear the sound of these musical instruments, we'll blow all the instruments again. And at the sound time that you hear it, fall, if you'll fall down and worship the image that I have made, very well. But if you don't, the furnace of blazing fire is what's there for you. If you don't, you will immediately be cast in the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. And what God is there who can deliver you out of my hands? What about that earlier confession in chapter 2 and verse 47, where he had acknowledged that the God of Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that their God is surely the God of gods and the Lord of kings and the revealer of mysteries? Whatever happened to that amazement and the fact that the man was impressed with the God of Daniel and his three friends? How quickly he had forgotten their God who had so impressed him earlier. Well, when these boys are offered a second opportunity, the text says, O King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. These three young men felt that they needed not to answer the king at all. His will had come into conflict with the will of the true king, their true king, the God of heaven. And that was the end of it for them. What I want you to understand is that for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, as I mentioned last night, even with some of the earlier things that we talked about, this was a settled issue for them. A settled issue for them. They knew very well what God's law said. They knew that when God revealed his will on Mount Sinai all those years ago when Moses was leading the people, that the Lord said, I am the Lord your God, Exodus 20 and verse 2. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven above or on earth beneath or in the water under the earth. You shall not worship them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing loving kindness to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. They knew that God had forbidden the creation of images and the worship of images. They knew what God had said in the book of Deuteronomy, the sixth chapter, and in verse 13, a verse that Jesus actually quotes in the time of his temptation, you shall fear only the Lord your God. You shall worship him and swear by his name. They knew that he was the only one that they could worship. And so they felt for them, it was a settled issue. They didn't need to deliberate. We don't read in this story that as soon as this ultimatum is given, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they get together and they kind of huddle together and talk about it. Okay, let's weigh the pros and cons. Let's talk about this issue. They don't do that. They don't even think about it. I mean, it's just an immediate response. We don't need to answer you with regard to this matter. It was a settled issue. And that was because earlier in their life, they had made a resolution. They had decided to serve God and obey his commands as revealed in the first chapter of Daniel, verses 8 to 13. And so they continue. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he doesn't, even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. I'm sorry, sir. We simply cannot do it. We need to let you know that that is where we stand, and we will not be moved about this issue. Boy, you got to admire the courage. And remember, we're not talking about 40 or 50-year-old men. We're talking about young men. Maybe in their late teens, maybe in their mid-teens, certainly not more than in their early 20s. These are young men. And you just got to marvel at the commitment and the determination to do the right thing. They don't even have to think about it. The will of the king had come in conflict with the will of their king. And that was the end of it. I want you to think a minute about the way we sometimes approach situations like this. And think about if they had approached this situation like we do, they could have come up with a number of pretty good excuses for going ahead on this occasion and bowing to the idol. They could have reasoned, you know, there's only three of us. What can just three of us do? Sometimes that's the way we think. You know, we're so outnumbered. What difference can it possibly make if we buck the system? They could have thought that way. They could have reasoned, well, you know, we're so young. What can be expected of us since we are so young? They would have been right that they were young. They could have reasoned, we're so far away from home. Who would ever know that we did it? Well, unless there's some Jews around here that would know, but they've all bowed themselves already. They could have reasoned that way. They could have reasoned, hey, everyone else is doing it. Why can't we do it too? Young people, you ever reason that way about things? Now, it's not just young people who reason that way. By the way, I kind of get off. I don't get pleased sometimes when preachers pick on young folks. Sometimes we say, young people need to straighten up. And some of the things we accuse young people of doing, the very things that older people are doing. Older people make excuses like this. Everybody's doing it. Why can't we do it too? They could have reasoned, and this would have been maybe more noble in some way. Hey, you know, if we don't bow, we die. But if we do bow, we can live a long life for God. Wouldn't that be a good thing? I mean, wouldn't that be good to be able to live a long life for God? That's the way they could have reasoned. We might even look at that and say, well, that's kind of a good way to think. It's not a good way to think. They could have said, it's just an idol. Why not let's just go through the motions? We won't mean it as we do it. We know it's just a dumb idol. We'll just kind of go through the motions. We don't have to do it in genuineness. Nobody has to get upset. They could have done that. They could have reasoned, what if we do it just this once? Just once won't matter. Sometimes we're thinking about looking at something we ought not to look at or get involved in something that we ought not to get involved in, and we think, what about, you know, just one time wouldn't hurt anything, would it? They could have reasoned that way. And I would suggest to you that had they reasoned that way, they would not have been pleasing to God. All of these excuses are the deceptions of Satan, but these three young men resisted them all. And we need to resist them too. And please understand that these excuses, they're not in the text. I didn't get those from the text. You know where I got those? From watching and listening to people. Because that's the very way we sometimes reason. They could have done that, but they resisted all of them. And so these three young men make it clear. O king, your will has come into conflict with the will of our true king, our God. That settles it. We can't bow down. We won't bow down. And though our God can deliver us, if he chooses not to, we're still not going to bow down. There's a little question we might interject at this point. Where's Daniel in all this? Maybe he bowed. Maybe that's why he's not here. Maybe he bowed. You really think that's what happened? that Daniel's not here because he bowed? Do we even know if he was in town at the time? Maybe he was away on a king's errand. I don't know. I know this much from what we have already learned about Daniel, that if he had been there, there would have been four men in the fire. So evidently he's not there. And these men stand alone and against this king. Well, it's kind of interesting because earlier in the text we were told that the king was enraged, and you know, we look at that and think, well, that's pretty bad. But I'll tell you what, you think the king was ticked off then, earlier, when he first found out about this? He is really ticked now. Because when we get at verse 19, King Nebuchadnezzar was filled with wrath, and his facial expression altered toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I mean, this was so bad that you could actually physically see a change in the amount of rage that was built up in this king because of these three men's response. He answered by giving orders to heat the furnace seven times more than it usually was heated. And he commanded certain valiant warriors who were in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in order to cast them into the furnace of fire. And when you think about this king heating the fire seven times hotter than it had been, you wonder, how hot is that? Well, verse 21 says, then these men were tied up, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They were tied up in their trousers, their coats, their caps, their other clothes, and were cast in the midst of the blazing furnace, or the blazing fire. And for this reason, because the king's command was urgent and the furnace had been made extremely hot, the flames slew those men who carried up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You know, sometimes when a house catches on fire, sometimes people die of smoke inhalation. And on some occasions people die because they get burned up, but most of the time people die, or a lot of times people die, because they breathe such hot air coming from the flames of those fires. And evidently this flame was so hot that as these men were, these strong warriors were throwing them, these valiant warriors throwing these men into the fire, getting close enough to throw them into the fire was enough to take their lives, to kill them. And so these men are killed, and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they fall down into the fire in the midst of the furnace of blazing fire, still tied up. It looks bad. It looks real bad. Hang on. Nebuchadnezzar the king was astounded and stood up in haste and said to the high officials, was it not three men we cast into the midst of the fire? They replied to the king, certainly, O king. And he said, well, look, I see four men loose and walking about in the midst of the fire without harm. And the appearance of the fourth is like the son of the gods. He saw these men as he looked and watched these men, expecting to see them burn up. Saw them fall down tied into the fire. Saw his valiant warriors slain by the heat of the fire. Surprised to see four men walking around in the fire. They're loose and walking around in the fire. And I want you to contrast verse 25, contrast loosed and walking about in the fire. Contrast with that verse 27, which tells us about as these men came out, that the fire that had totally had no effect on the bodies or the clothes of these men, that didn't even singe their hair or pass its smell onto them, that fire that had absolutely no effect on them somehow burned the bonds that bound them. That's not divine irony, I don't know. Don't tell me God doesn't have a sense of humor. And so Nebuchadnezzar is astounded. And Nebuchadnezzar says, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, "Come out, you servants of the Most High God, and come here." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the midst of the fire. The satraps and the prefects and the governors and the king's high officials gathered around and saw in regard to these men that the fire had had no effect on the bodies of these men, nor was the head of their head singed, nor were their trousers damaged, nor had the smell of fire even come upon them. They were totally unaffected in any negative way by this fire. I would suggest to you that it's probably safe to say that now the tone of Nebuchadnezzar is radically changed. No longer is he enraged at these men. No longer is he yelling at them in a wild temper tantrum. Now he's asking them, "Come out. You don't dictate to people like this, I'm telling you." And in verse 28, the king says, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants who put their trust in him, violating the king's command, and yielding up their bodies so as not to serve or worship any god except their own." Blessed be the God of these men who can invoke that kind of confidence and trust, that kind of devotion. What a great God this must be, who men will actually allow themselves to sacrifice their bodies in the service of this God in order to keep the precepts of this God. You know, Nebuchadnezzar's own invention at this point is forgotten. The silent, lifeless, and powerless image is now out of the picture. That big 90-foot image that he had built is out of the picture. Now it is only the God of these three Jewish men who is worthy of being praised. Only he deserves to be bowed down to. Therefore, in verse 29, he decrees, "I make a decree that any people, nation, or tongue that speaks anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb, and their houses reduced to rubbish heaps, inasmuch as there is no other God who is able to deliver in this way." His earlier decree has been changed. It has been nullified by the powerful God of these Jewish boys. And so now Nebuchadnezzar knows what kind of a decree he must make if he's going to stand. He must make a decree that exalts Jehovah, that Jehovah God is to be praised, and these servants are to be elevated. And this God is the God that you and I serve today. This is a historical narrative. These are events that actually occurred in time and space. And they involve the exact same God that we're trying to hold up to you tonight. That we're trying to say to you, here is the God that you need to put your trust in. This is a God who can save you. He can save you from your sins. He can save you in eternity. He can save you in the ways that you most need salvation. Other gods cannot do that, for they are not gods. Only the God that we're reading about here is the true God. He is our God. He is the God that we seek to serve. And I want to know if He's your God. And if He is not, will you recognize that He is the only one worthy of praise and honor? You can't find a God who can do what we've talked about tonight, except Jehovah God. And if you'll make Him your God by putting your trust in Him tonight, trusting His Son as our Savior, who bled and died to remove our sins, if you will have confidence in this God, and express your confidence in this God by submitting yourself in baptism, you can have your sins washed away. And you can rise and walk in newness of life. Make it a settled issue tonight while we stand and sing with Rod.